So, the Heart Sutra that we just chanted. The Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra, or sometimes it's called the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra in English. But usually we abbreviate it and call it the Heart Sutra, is the most frequently chanted text in Zen monasteries and practice centers, and probably the most well-known and revered text throughout the Mahayana Buddhist world, which is includes the Buddhist traditions of China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and Tibet, and now the West. And in those traditional, in the earlier traditions of those countries, it would have been most often chanted as a dharani. A dharani is a kind of invocation used for its spiritual power, a power of protection and support. So we chant, there's two that we do. We do the Daihi Shin Dharani, which is the Heart of Great Compassion Dharani, and we do the Shosai Kichijo Dharani, which is a dharani for protection from hindrance and natural disasters of many kinds, or disasters of many kinds. So these are used more as, they're kind of like prayers. And they were used for their spiritual power in those, and I'd say in those days, to this day. And most people would be chanting it without understanding, you know, chanting the words, but without understanding the deep meaning, and without an understanding that they should. But and in those traditional Buddhist cultures, the primary practices of lay people were considered to be right conduct, following the precepts, and generosity. Whereas the cultivation of meditative concentration and wisdom was considered to be for the full-time monastics. Well, here in the West, we want it all, right? Most people come to Buddhist practice wanting to learn meditation. We want to learn how to have a quiet, peaceful mind. We might not actually be very interested in reading ancient Buddhist texts, let alone chanting them. And if we do chant them, we want to know what we're chanting. No, what does this mean, right? We come from a culture of rational materialism. We like things to make sense. We need to understand. So we're a bit uncomfortable with language like form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form. What the heck does that mean, right? So, here at the Zendo, we do talk about the content of these ancient texts periodically. It's good to take a close look at the Heart Sutra. It's only one page long in English translation, but it's a condensation of the core teaching, or heart, of Mahayana Buddhism. So that's what we'll do over the next few weeks. We'll go through it line by line and see what it reveals to us. Seems like we do it every few years. So for those who haven't done this before, maybe it'll help you to kind of get a little bit of a handle on the Heart Sutra, and those who have, it'll be a review, which is always good. And we'll touch on some issues of language and translation as we go, but I don't want to be academic about this. I'm not a scholar of Sanskrit or Chinese, so I can only rely on the work of others and take it all with a grain of salt. And Michael and I will each take some turns with this. We want to give you some background and some keys to unlock the Heart Sutra. And so it will be relevant to your actual practice in everyday lives. So a little bit of background. It is helpful to see the Heart Sutra in the context of the development of Mahayana Buddhism. In the centuries following the Buddha's death, life and death, many schools of Buddhism proliferated. And around the beginning of the Common Era, a school arose that emphasized wisdom, or prajna. Prajna means wisdom. And the ideal of the bodhisattva, right, the being who forgoes the attainment of ultimate Buddhahood to aid others, to serve others, to be free from suffering. The path of the bodhisattva was part of the Buddha's teaching from the beginning, but in early Buddhism it was seen more as this arduous path that very few could follow, and that would take lifetime after lifetime, countless lifetimes, and then out there in the unimaginable distant future would be Buddhahood, where one would step off the wheel of birth and rebirth for good. And the Mahayana movement arose in part in a response to a tendency among some schools of Buddhism to get mired in a kind of very academic analysis of texts. And in particular, it arose in reaction to a school called the Sarvastivadin school that taught that phenomena do have an essential reality or distinct existence, which is quite different from what most people understand, is what the Buddha taught. So one cluster of these Mahayana texts, which grew up around in those early years of the Common Era, one cluster of these texts is called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And there are both longer and shorter versions of them, written between about 300 and 700 of the Common Era. And so the Heart Sutra is considered a highly condensed version of these teachings, these Perfection of Wisdom teachings. But for all its popularity, no one really knows exactly when or by whom it was written. It's lost in the mists of time. The earliest record of it is a Chinese translation by a Central Asian monk called Jurchen from the early 3rd century, when Buddhism was flourishing in what's now Afghanistan, the Gandhara era in northern India. And because written records are incomplete, there's a difference of opinion, as there always is among scholars, as to whether the Heart Sutra was first composed in Sanskrit and translated into Chinese, or first composed in Chinese and then translated almost backwards into Sanskrit. But it seems the prevalent understanding is that there was a Sanskrit version first. In those days, cultural exchange was flowing back and forth, right? Along the Silk Road. But the Heart Sutra didn't become well known until a Chinese monk named Xuanzang made his famous journey from China into India and back in the 8th century. Apparently, according to legend, chanting the Heart Sutra repeatedly as to ward off demons, dust storms, and bandits. So he's chanting it as a Dharani, right, to ward off dangers. And then he later made his own translation of the text, which spread and became popular. And many commentaries have since been written, many translations, and now including English ones, and English commentaries. Some of the ones that I've used, looked at, are commentaries by Shohaku Okumura, Michael's and my first Soto Zen teacher in Japan, Thich Nhat Hanh, Red Pine, and Musong. I'm sure there are others. And also I looked at a very irreverent commentary by Hakuin Zenji. It's quite amusing, actually. Hakuin Zenji, the 18th century Japanese Rinzai Zen master. So I might draw on some of these as we go. So let's start at the very beginning. with the title, Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra. Or as you, if you look just on this, the next page in your chant book, is the Sino-Japanese, Maka Hanya Haramita Shingyo. As I said, in our old chant book years ago, it was translated as Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom, Heart Sutra, and that's a little bit closer to the word order. The title in Sino-Japanese is a combination of a Japanese transliteration of Sanskrit and Chinese. So Maka Hanya Haramita, that comes from Sanskrit. So Maka is great, Maha. Bodhisattva, Mahasattva is great being, great. Hanya is wisdom. Hanya is prajna. And Haramita is paramita. So Maha, prajna, paramita. That's what that's saying. That's somehow got mangled in the translation, in the Japanese transliteration. And then Shingyo is from the Chinese. believe it or not. Shin is the character for heart and mind, and Gyo for sutra. So prajna, wisdom, actually in Buddhist thought there are three kinds of wisdom. The first is the wisdom of the relative, of everyday life, by which we make distinctions between permanence and impermanence, self and other, wholesome and unwholesome. You know, to negotiate our daily lives, we have to make those distinctions, don't we? Or else everything would just be a big blobby mess. Sort of is, anyway. So we need this kind of wisdom in the relative world, but if that's all we know, we get trapped in our conditioned, rigid views, you know, that there's so many ways that we're conditioned in our views. So we need the second kind of wisdom, which is called the wisdom of the absolute or the ultimate, by which we realize that what we conventionally see as permanent is impermanent. What we see as ourself is really not this bounded small self, but infinitely interconnected. And what we think of as pure and good is only provisionally so. Shifting sands. But this kind of wisdom too can trap us into another version of stuckness. We can get stuck on that side of the absolute, of absolute wisdom, and then not be able to make the important distinctions in everyday life. You know, oh, there's no you, no me, so why don't I just take you, you know, take what you have. Why don't I just run you through with my sword, because there's no life, no death. That was used in Japan as a rationale during World War II for militarism. You know, so we have to then have the third kind of wisdom, which is called wisdom beyond wisdom, that recognizes both the relative and the absolute at once. Both are simultaneously true and not true. And this is the wisdom that opens into compassion, which mediates between those two sides, so that we can act in the world with both wisdom and compassion. And that's the wisdom that the Heart Sutra actually is talking about, the wisdom beyond wisdom that encompasses both the others. And this word paramita sometimes is being used to express this wisdom beyond wisdom. According to scholarly etymology, the paramita can mean pinnacle or perfection. Sometimes the paramitas are called perfections, which I kind of cringe with that translation, because there's so much of a tendency, we have in our culture very strong perfectionist tendencies, and that's not necessarily what this is about. So sometimes paramita means can be said to mean going beyond or transcending, or in some commentaries, leading to the other shore. So it's, we can think of it as going beyond being sticking anywhere in the relative or the absolute, going beyond duality. So prajna paramita, the paramita of wisdom, is also the name given to a kind of archetypal female figure. And we chant a chant to her, not in our ordinary services here, but when we have sesshin, homage to prajna paramita, mother of all Buddhas. So this wisdom beyond wisdom gives birth to Buddhas, gives birth to our Buddha nature. There's this image of prajna paramita as the mother of our Buddha nature. And then, as I said, shin is the translation, it's the Chinese translation of the Sanskrit word hridaya, H-R-I-D-A-Y-A, which means heart or core. It's also used in titles to indicate a summary. And so, as you know, as I said, this is a condensation or a kind of core of much longer texts. And then, of course, gyo is the word sutra, which is traditionally used for the earliest Buddhist texts, which were from the Pali canon, which came from the earliest recorded Buddhist texts. And the word sutra is related to the word suture, stitched together. But the Heart Sutra, as I said, it was formerly not considered a sutra or called a sutra. It was a dharani. It only began to be called a sutra in the 7th century, so way past the time of the Buddha. So that's the title. We always start with the title. And the text begins by setting the scene. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing prajna paramita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So it's very significant that this teaching is being delivered by Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. So a sort of archetypal figure, not a historical figure. And delivered to Shariputra. We'll talk more about him next week, but he's a disciple, one of the historical disciples of the Buddha. So whether profound wisdom opens into compassion, or profound compassion opens into wisdom, or they co-arise, the two qualities are considered the two wings of our practice, without which we can't fly. They need to be in balance. And the name Avalokiteshvara can be translated as the one who looks down, so implying looking down on suffering beings with compassion. And it was translated into Chinese as Guan Shiryin or Guan Yin, you've heard that. And Japanese Kanzeon or Kannon, one who hears or looks down on the sounds, and so we say hears the sounds or the cries of the world. So that Kanzeon, that name will be familiar to you from our Emmejuku Kanongyo that we chant, which is the long life 10-verse Kanon Sutra. Michael talked about it on a Sunday recently. So that's again the same Bodhisattva we're talking about, Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara is deeply practicing prajna paramita, the paramita of wisdom. So just to briefly recognize that wisdom is only one of the paramitas. In some formats there are 10, but we'll just talk, just to briefly mention the six that are that play a really central role in Mahayana Buddhist teaching, and they are generosity, morality or right conduct, patience, vigor or energy, concentration, and wisdom. And I've got a little list here. I think I'm going to wait till next week to give you this. It's the Heart Sutra keys. Mm-hmm. So it's like this is all that's compressed into the Heart Sutra. And it'll give you the paw. You want it now? Now I have to give it to you. Okay, here, pass it out. Go ahead, pass it out. But bring it back, or else leave it here. Okay. So we're going to have to pass it. So don't take it home and leave it, because you need it more next week than this week. Okay? Point being, these paramitas are actual practices we cultivate on the Bodhisattva path, and they overlap with elements of the Eightfold Path, which is the earlier, what the Buddha taught. So you'll see areas that where they overlap with the Eightfold Path. And they interpenetrate and support each other in the same way that the elements of the Eightfold Path interpenetrate and support each other. They aren't linear. And so I just think it's important, because the Heart Sutra focuses on wisdom, that we acknowledge the other paramitas, without which, without the others, wisdom alone would become kind of lifeless and rigid. And without wisdom, the other paramitas would be unbalanced. It's very important the way these practices work with each other. So, Avalokiteshvara, deeply practicing Prajnaparamita through direct experience in meditation, sees that all five aggregates are empty. So here's another word, aggregates. Aggregates is a translation for the word skandhas, or skanda. And from now on, I'm just going to say skanda, because aggregate sounds too much like cement. And skanda is a hard word to translate. So I think it's better just to leave it as it is, say skanda. Some of the possible things it means are like a trunk, as of a tree, or a bundle, or a cluster, like a bundle of firewood. These are some of the traditional translations. So the five skandhas are a Buddhist construct that describe a kind of model of how our being, our mind and body are put together. These are the elements of it. So then it's a bundle, right? That's why it's called an aggregate. So we'll just say skanda. Freud came up with ego, id, and superego. They don't actually exist. It's a construct. And so same thing with these. It's a way of helping us to understand how we function, which may or may not help. So the five skandhas are, and you'll see them on your little list there, form, rupa, sensation, or vedana, perception, sanjna, formation, sanskara, and consciousness, vijnana. So that all sounds rather abstract. So let's see if we can articulate what each of those is. Form refers to what we usually consider the material world, the phenomenal world. Form. Right. Our most intimate relationship to form is our own body, and how we move it through the world, the physical world, and encounter the physical world through our senses, which we'll come to later. The other four skandhas pertain to what we usually call mind, but in fact are not separate from form, our body. So sensation refers to our most basic response to stimulus, our initial assessment in everything we encounter, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or kind of neutral. That's how we're wired to with whatever it is, whether it's a sound or a sight or a taste. Is that pleasant, unpleasant? Do I want to approach or retreat? You know, very primal. So that's sensation, at least in this construct. Perception is then how we notice and name and conceptualize those sensations, okay? Which we do both through image and language. And our perceptions are conditioned by our past experience, right? So dog barking, one person might experience that in one way and another person might experience it quite a different way, or I might experience it in a different way depending on whether it's a dog that I love and is happy to greet me, or whether it's my neighbor's nasty dog, right? So that's the perception, how we interpret those sensations, and our perceptions, of course, can be distorted depending on our conditioning. Formation then refers to what are called mental formations. Sometimes this is translated as volition or memory, but both of them seem a little narrow. The full complexity, the range of what were called formations, are all our emotional and thought patterns. Okay, so guilt, and there's not a distinction between thought and feeling, thought and emotion here. So guilt, envy, doubt, joy, kindness, pride, confidence, all the stories we tell about ourselves and who we are and what we're not, what we are, what we're not. Those are all formations. Okay? How we interpret and make sense of our interactions with the world around us. And again, we can be mistaken, right? It's easy to see how everybody else is mistaken, but we can be mistaken. Our interpretation of our experience is always partial. It's always provisional, always subject to change. We never have the whole picture. It's impossible, right? So the fifth skanda is consciousness. So consciousness is this matrix of awareness within which all these other skandhas function. And not all of it is conscious. Much of our awareness and our response to our surroundings takes place beneath our conscious awareness. So, you know, partly when we're doing our sitting practice, some more comes into our conscious awareness than typically when we're just out and about in our daily lives. So it's a little bit different construct than, you know, id, ego, and superego. It's a little, and it is just a construct, but it helps us a little, it just helps us to be aware of mind and body, how we function. Okay, so let's try a little five skandhas case history. Let's say you're a very young child. You're 2 or 3. And you're out in the backyard, and you say there's a garden, and you see a little buzzing insect, and it's really cute. It's fuzzy and black, and it has little black and yellow stripes on its belly and its abdomen, and it's all fuzzy. It looks really cute, and it's kind of looks like it's eating in a flower. And you're really curious about it, and you don't know what it is. So you reach out to pick it up and look, and suddenly you feel this sharp, painful sensation. Your experience has suddenly become very unpleasant. You still don't have a name for it, right? You run screaming to the nearest adult. And your subsequent mental formations about bees will be highly influenced by the way that adult handles your fear and your pain. If that adult remains calm and does not scold you for getting stung, does not say, oh, you don't do that, don't go near bees, blah, 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 right? No. If the adult stays calm and carefully brushes the stinger away and soothes that sting with some ammonia or maybe some mud pack works well, holds you in a safe and comforting way. And when you've settled down, maybe you look at some pictures of bees and you find out how hard they work and how they have to defend themselves sometimes and how they pollinate the flowers and the vegetables and the fruit so that we have food to eat. And then maybe you spend a little more time out in the garden with that adult just watching the bees at work. So you might even grow up to be one of those beekeepers who is so attuned to bees that there is no separation between your consciousness and theirs. Have you ever heard of those magic beekeepers, you know, who can just go out and tune into the bees? Mm. They can. So you can imagine other possible scenarios that are less fortunate. But I hope this gives you a little bit of an example of how the skandhas work. You know, this sort of succession of mental, of body-mind events inside us that shape our experience then. Might also tell you a little bit about how to do emotional trauma first aid with children. But back to Avalokiteshvara, deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly seeing that all five skandhas are empty. So this word empty has been problematic ever since it was first chosen to translate the Sanskrit word shunya or shunyata into English. Shunya does not mean void or hollow or zero. Oh, sorry, it does. It does mean void, hollow, or zero. Sorry, don't want to throw you off. But in English, these words have such a negative, have negative associations. And that's not the sense of this Buddhist term. Kaz Tanahashi, when he has translated this, uses the word boundlessness to avoid these kind of negative associations in English. And I like that. I like boundlessness because it communicates that sense of no separate existence, because that is the sense of this word emptiness, as empty of self-existence, not having a separate self, only existing within this matrix of arising and passing of phenomena, connected to all phenomena. Thich Nhat Hanh, in his commentary, points out that empty has no meaning unless we know what is empty of what. A glass may be empty of water, but not empty of air. Right? So what the five skandhas are empty of is permanent, separate, distinct existence. They only exist in complete interaction with each other in constructing our experience. And so that's just setting off this whole message of the Heart Sutra about emptiness. This is where it starts. As the skandhas, as interrelated functions constantly in flux. And this vision of emptiness is full of possibility. It's very dynamic, right? The Japanese Buddhist philosopher Masao Abe says, precisely because it is emptiness which empties even emptiness, true emptiness is absolute reality which makes all phenomena, all existence truly be.
Can you repeat?
Sounds a little like Dogen, doesn't it? Precisely because it is emptiness which empties even emptiness, meaning don't get stuck. Yeah, emptiness, you know.
The emptiness of emptiness,
yeah. True emptiness is absolute reality, which makes all phenomena, all existence truly be. Okay. Yeah, so complete, dynamic, interconnection and change. We talked about this at the Dogen retreat in looking at Dogen's Uji, or being time. So when we sit in zazen, we have the opportunity to directly experience, just like Avalokiteshvara, the emptiness of the five skandhas, because we are paying attention to our moment-to-moment experience. And when we truly understand the emptiness of the five skandhas, we will realize that there is nothing to hold on to, nothing to push away, and we will be released from our hard-held suffering, just like Avalokiteshvara. There seems to be some ambiguity in that final words of the sentence, thus relieved all suffering. Some versions say Avalokiteshvara was saved from all suffering, and some use the active relieved all suffering. Maybe there's no difference. Really, Avalokiteshvara's freedom from suffering is our freedom from suffering, and ours is our neighbor's freedom from suffering. If I am able to see the emptiness of my defensive conditioned reactions to my neighbor and not generate harsh retaliatory words or actions I might otherwise have engaged in, both I and my neighbor are freed from suffering. So this is something you can observe. You know, it all sounds very, you know, maybe abstract, but you can observe this in your everyday life and practice. The emptiness of the five skandhas does not have to be an abstract concept. If you find yourself saying to your three-year-old, don't cry, that bee is just an illusion, I'd say you've become too attached to the concept of emptiness. So as an antidote, we'll look more at Avalokiteshvara's teaching next week. So we made it through the title and the first sentence. That's typically how you approach these things. You spend the whole first session on the title and the first sentence. But we'll pick up speed as we move, now that you have that basis. Okay, so we have a little bit of time left. What I'd like you to do is, I don't know whether we have time for threes. Yeah, I think we do. Group up quickly in threes and just think of an example, a direct experience of how seeing the emptiness of the five skandhas has or could relieve suffering in your life, in your actual experience. See what you come up with. How could seeing the emptiness or boundlessness of the five skandhas actually free you? See what you come up with. Okay.